The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
All of us have healing work to do on race and culture topics. We have those questions that seem to be unaskable in today's climate. Now, we have a forum where we can ask experts, listen, and share. Welcome to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. Get ready to engage and add your voice to racial healing in the next hour. Let's start right now. Here's Sharon E. Davis.
I'm delighted that you're taking time out of your busy day to join us once again. Well, you know, racism is not our fault. We were born into parts of this story, but we don't always know the other stories. And we're in the process of digging our way out of this ditch that we've learned our way into. Yep, we erroneously learned our way into racism, and we will intentionally learn our way out. And you know, to learn our way out, the answers really are within us. And that's what racial healing is about. And we have a lifelong time on this journey, and part of that starts with this show. Well, today's episode is, Do Black Women Impact the USA? Really? How? Who dares in today's racial environment to openly talk about the African American woman? Is there such a person as the strong black woman? What does that mean? Some say it's not good for future of families, while others admire and applaud it as survival. What impact has she driven and influenced? Is there really anything remarkably different about the histories of black women in the United States? Has she been pushed into the shadows of history without us knowing the real impact? Is there an attraction to her by white and other males that may be responsible for a whole lot of race mixing? Can a culture of women be the least valued at times and the most influential of women? Well, who was Ida B. Wells? Was she really that powerful? Well, today our guest is Professor Paula Giddings, and she's going to open the door for all of us to see and understand. Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, and national news outlets declare that Paula's extraordinary insights set a standard on black women and race. Well, Paula, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Sharon. I hope I can live up to that introduction. Thank you.
Well, I know that you have more information than others out there have, and so we're just delighted you've taken time to share a lot of that with us today. The program is going to go very fast, I know. Well, you know, with this topic in mind, before we get into some of the details about it and the expertise and research that you bring to it, could you share with our listening audience, why do you do this work? Why did you choose this particular area to focus on?
Well, Sharon, you know, I always loved to write, and I was reared in Yonkers, New York, and went to a predominantly white high school, junior high school, and I'm old enough to have been in junior high school when the Freedom Rides started in 1961. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was 13 years old at the time, and I had such an impression on me as I watched young people who actually weren't that much older than I was at the time, who would, if you remember the Freedom Rides, it was the idea was to try to get the federal government to intervene. Mm-hmm. Because there is an anti-discrimination statute in interstate commerce law. And so what the Freedom Riders decided to do was to get on buses, start in the north, and then go to the south and desegregate waiting rooms, which were under the ICC. So in 61, this was a strategy, And I remember watching people board those buses in the north and then watch what happened to them as they went south into Anniston, Alabama, and Virginia and other places, and the violence that took place there. If you remember, sometimes some of the buses were firebombed. People were yanked off the buses. People were beaten.
I remember thinking,
and I didn't intellectualize it yet, but I know this is where the germ of my ideas started. I said, what in the world is this thing called race that is so powerful that could make people hate like that? Who could attack innocent people like that? But I also wondered, what was it about race that made people so courageous? I mean, people, if you remember, the first wave of rides was so violent that the head of CORE decided, Congress of Racial Equality, whose idea it was, decided to stop the freedom rides. But it was young people who said, you know, we can't stop. We can't let them defeat us this way. And so they took over. They got on those buses. They started writing their wills in case they died.
Oh my gosh.
The courage was just extraordinary. And I also asked, where does the courage come from? What does it mean to find something that's bigger than yourself, that's more important than your own life? To me, race, to try to find out about race, was what was going to answer those questions. And so that was kind of the beginning of a lifelong career of mine in terms of writing and thinking about race.
Well, that certainly was an impact both visually and emotionally and intellectually and everything else, it sounds like, Paula.
Absolutely. And, of course, remember, the movement was televised. And so saw, you know, all this on television. And the last thing is that I remember, though, afterwards, going to my predominantly white school, and nobody talked about it. It was as if it hadn't happened. And I realized, I didn't realize it then, but now I understand that we really didn't have a language to really talk about it in a way that we can now. And a lot of people, which is why the idea for this, the concept of the show is so wonderful, a lot of people still don't have a way, they don't understand how to think about race and how to talk about it. I have students who, even in my classes, who, you know, who are afraid of offending somebody or not understanding something. And so you really do have to develop this way of conversing about the subject.
Well, this is extraordinary, and, you know, you're actually giving me chills thinking about the Freedom Riders and what happened during that period of time and not being able to, at times at a younger age, to fully deal with the emotions of it as a younger person. Well, Paula, throughout the course of years, you're a professor at Smith College, and you have many accolades behind your name that I didn't even list. They're on our website and on Voice America as well. You know, with our topic today, the focus seems to be about that courage. And speaking of courage, who dares in today's environment to openly talk about African-American women? And the strong black, is there such a thing as a strong black woman? What does that mean?
Well, it's a really interesting question because, and of course, think about, because black women, African-American women as a group, never had the protections of other women, weren't shielded in ways other women were, that they certainly had to engage diversity and transcend diversity in ways all throughout our history. And we have a pretty good idea from slavery on, and through discrimination and segregation on. And what's interesting about the idea of the strong black woman was that, you know, for so long, I think, and I am generalizing here, but long, it was really with much more pride than resentment that one spoke about strong black women, about the competency of black women, about the appreciation of the strength that black women have. If you remember Alice Walker's definition of womanism has talks about the appreciation for black women's commitment to survival. and of their strength. And but by the 1960s, that kind of idea began to change, first in kind of subtle ways, and then in a very explicit way that created a lot of controversy and a lot of debate. And that was, if you remember, even historically, but I also remember this, was the issue of the something called the Moynihan Report.
Oh, yeah.
In 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Secretary of Labor, writes a report and that, in fact, what was happening with African Americans was not so much what all the external racism that was going on. If you remember, this is the 60s, including those freedom rides, including riots, including the assassination of those little girls in Birmingham, including the Medgar Evers assassination, unemployment, underemployment. But what he concluded was, which is a part of this war on poverty idea that Lyndon Johnson brought forth, what he concluded was that at the heart of the black problems is the dysfunction of the black family. And at the heart of the dysfunction of the black family are black women who are matriarchs. Mm-hmm. That they are so strong, in fact, that they just make men dispirited.
Oh, my gosh.
And this leads to the breakup of the family, the dysfunction of the family. And that until this question is resolved, until that question is resolved, there's no use in trying to deal with poverty issues or rights, political rights issues. If you remember, this is also the year people are fighting for the Voting Rights Act and for the Civil Rights Act that's been passed in 64. But what Moynihan concluded was that really would mean very little unless we got to the heart of this problem of the family and of the, quote, strong black woman.
Well, Paula, it just makes it sound like that black women were identified as being just totally out of control or in control or both.
Well, and mostly in. and I must say, though, to remember that this is in a broader context of mm-hmm. what a lot of people call the male revolt of the period. Okay. This was within a context of men who, as a result of socioeconomic changes, who were no longer sort of those rugged individualists, but were becoming a part of corporate America after World War II, and who were feeling that they had to sort of obsequiously deal with their hierarchies, and that they were being henpecked at home. You know, a lot of the popular culture was around men being henpecked, and this is the idea of the gray flannel suit dissenters, if you remember there. So the African American part of it was also now fortified by the Moynihan Report, and also by the Black Power movement, which has a much more nationalist sort of strain. It's different than the civil rights movement and the mm-hmm. roles that it foresaw for women.
Well, you know, this is quite a story in the context of what was happening. And I just love that, Paula, because, you know, without us understanding the context, it would just make it seem just that this is focused on black people or African-American people and solely on African-American women. But it doesn't sound like that's totally the case.
No. And remember, this is also the period of the women's movement in general as well, of the general women's movement, and a lot of pushback of women wanting their rights, of women trying to change their roles in society. So it is part and parcel of that.
Wow, wow. Well, I tell you, Paula, we're going to come back in just a few minutes and continue on with Do Black Women Impact the USA and How? We'll be right back.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com. Many people are seeking to make a difference in the world, but few actually have the tools to do so. Every week, host Mary Beth Lodge and her guests will have you thinking forward and will give you the tips to keep your life, goals, priorities, and choices on track. The result is an easier, happier, and more inspired life. The name of the program is What Matters. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. What really matters is the positive changes that you'll bring to your life and the world just by listening. Come back to your senses. Imagine a radio show that will help you recover your common sense. Host Leah Brenda Smith is a health and wellness specialist who will explain techniques designed to help you recover from the stress of your life. It's all about how you respond to your thoughts. A little bit of self-awareness can go a long way in helping you to relax and enjoy your life. Tune in to Come Back to Your Senses Radio, live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back. Our guest today is Paula Giddings, who is a professor at Smith College. And Paula, before we went on break, you were telling us this really very interesting context of what really came to be considered the pride or appeal of a strong black woman, and that idea and notion of that in the famous or infamous Moynihan Report of 1965 that concluded the heart of the problem really was the black woman as matriarchs of family. Well, if we come back to this, you know, you also mentioned as a part of your particular history about the Freedom Riders, and there's a Viola Leuso from Michigan, who was killed when she was trying to help us, as Annie May from Mississippi was a caller earlier today and wanted us to kind of focus a bit on that, and that she was a white woman trying to help a black woman. Well, where would you like to begin our second segment here, Paula?
Well, the sometimes we do forget that the civil rights movement was an interracial movement, and that certainly there were a number of white heroic people who were important to the African American struggle, and including, by the way, those Freedom Riders. A number of them were white as well, and it also shows you, I think, even more as importantly in that, is that this was an issue that was not just about race itself, but also about power and about about a way of life that was going to change, and anybody who got in the way of that was going to pay was going to pay for it. So the courage, and but also what is sometimes unrecognized, also unrecognized, I think, is the courage of African Americans, particularly in the rural South, who had no place to return to once they became very involved in that struggle, and once they became publicly involved there. A number of workers who are all courageous, but, you know, there's a difference between those who could sort of go home to the North or go home to other places,
right,
and those, though, who really put their stakes down and who are going to have to live this thing out. And, you know, I think about the so-called strong black women. I think about also the women in places like that have been written about, particularly in Greenwood, Mississippi, in the early movement, in early 61, 62, before the federal government was really paying attention to them, before there was lots of protections and cameras,
who are very involved with voter registration and facing all kinds of dangers and punishments, not only physically but also in terms of their jobs and their whole families were put at risk with their working. So it was a moment, particularly that moment in time of the movement was quite extraordinary on both sides.
Well, you know, that might bring us up a little bit to today, because Annie Mae from Mississippi, as part of what her call was about, she says, "Must we always be on point? We can't rest," and I'm assuming that she is African-American. "Black women are still under assault. Education is under assault, and we're the most affected. America Dream promoted black women being targeted, and now it's hit with the current mortgage loans and subprimes," and she mentions other things as well related to that. And she says, trying to put the face of the welfare queen on black women, and as part of our society is bad mothers and not responsible. And when is this going to stop? And she says, when are they going to stop going after us? What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, one of the things I always try, and a number of us, I'm sure, try to grapple with is, how do you think about what is happening in the society now? How do you think about it? You know, I remember when President Obama got elected the first time, I said, "Boy, am I going to have to re-envision America?" with a brilliant black first lady, right? So, am I going to have to really re-envision what is going on? But I remembered some lessons that I learned from history, and I am going to get to the crux of the question. One is by a woman whose biography I wrote, by the name of Ida B. Wells, who started the first anti-lynching campaign. And she started in 1892. And what was so interesting about that period of time was it was a time of great progress in terms of African American people. They were building their institutions and their communities, Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard, political appointments. You know, a certain segment of the community was doing extraordinarily well, and in a way that, remember, this is only two generations of from slavery, and in a way that people would believe that they would never in their lifetime see. But at the same time, I mean, the number of lynchings also rose.
Right.
You know, at the same time, communities were becoming segregated. At the same time, the prison industrial complex was really starting just in this period of time, when blacks were being rounded up and put in prison, mainly for often for their labor as well. And corporations would actually lease them out. It was called the convict lease system.
Right.
So what Ida Wells had to figure out was what kinds of strategies do we need in a period like this? Because there was a group of people who would say, you know, the race question is really resolving itself. Look at all this progress. And then there were others who were saying, well, forget the progress. Look what's happening on the other side of it. But you have to acknowledge both. So all that is to say that we have on one level, we have extraordinary progress of African American women who are in places they've never been before, who are doing well. As I mentioned, to even who would ever think we'd see a first black lady in our lifetime? But on the other end, I mean, Anna Mae is absolutely right. I mean, we're also falling deeper and deeper into poverty. Mm-hmm. The subprime issue has resulted, perhaps, and I'm not an economist, so I'm a little wary about, but perhaps the largest transfer of wealth out of the black community that we've ever seen. And it was at a time when a number of black women are really beginning to buy homes when this recession hit and this subprime mess hit. I remember just before the recession, Sharon, I got a call from the Atlanta Constitution who wanted me to comment on the fact that so many single black women were buying homes in Atlanta. What does this mean? But you know, and I hate to think about what those what's happened to those women now, and
right,
to much
right.
of that property. So all this is happening. So the good stuff and the horrible stuff is happening at the same time, and so we have to figure out strategies and a way to look at the society to be clear about what's happening. So one of the things certainly this means is that we just can't assume because a segment of the community is doing so well. We should applaud it. We should understand why it's happening, and we should not forget it, that there is this success. But we also have to think about why there is not success for another group of African Americans in general and Black women in particular. That is how we try to look at, talk about the status of African American women, particularly of how we begin to resolve it with both of those exigencies in mind.
Well, you know, when you put it that way, once again, Paula, it just is, it adds so much clarity. And back with Ida B. Wells, and by the way, for our listening audience, your book on Ida B. Wells won a national award. So that's just wonderful. A winner
Thank
of the
you.
Los Angeles Times Book Prize in biography.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, along these lines, here during Ida B. Wells's time in what, the 1860s or something like that, or 1890s?
Yes, her campaign starts 1892, but she's born in 1860s. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for that period of time, here there was massive overt racism and primarily men being lynched, without recourse. And then you have Ida B. Wells. And, maybe we can just start a little bit before break. What impact did she drive and what influence did she have during this one of the worst of times? Can you start us out a little bit?
Yes, one of the worst of times, but as I mentioned, also one of the best of times happening at the same time. And one of the things that she had to battle were people who were saying, don't start all this agitation. And maybe the people who are being lynched maybe they've done something wrong anyway. It's not good, but maybe they've done something wrong. Let's concentrate on building our communities and getting rid of ignorance and accumulating wealth. So she had to figure out that kind of strategy, but she has a tremendous impact that perhaps we'll talk more about after the break. And it was an impact that she really, that this is really, you can argue that her anti-lynching campaign is the beginning of the modern civil rights movement.
Wait. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. Are you suggesting that maybe with the work of like an Ida B. Wells, that spawned considered?
Yes, her strategy and her way of looking at the world and the way she mobilized people and the philosophy she uses to mobilize people. I think you can make. This is a claim I did not try to prove in my book, but as I think about it more, that this is really the beginning, and we can talk more about it. You can see all of the seeds of the modern civil rights movement in her anti-lynching campaign.
Well, this campaign is not known enough about, with a number of people in our country. I feel, this is my bias, okay? All of us have biases. And one of my biases is that I don't know that people really know who Ida B. Wells is or was.
One of the reviews of my book said Ida Wells is probably the most important person most of us have never heard of.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well that sounds about right. And just maybe for in 30 seconds, she was born around when was her
born,
occupation?
1862, Holly Springs, Mississippi, is orphaned at an early age, goes to Memphis, becomes a school teacher, becomes a journalist, and a friend of hers is lynched in March 9th, 1892. She begins to investigate lynchings, and she begins to And it's a catalyst for her beginning an anti-lynching campaign that begins in Memphis.
Oh, my gosh. So she got
personal. She's exiled, as you can imagine, from, excuse me, from Memphis.
Okay, well, we will be right back. We'll take a break and we'll be right back.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back with our guest, Professor Paula Giddings, who is author, journalist, and professor at Smith College. Before we went on break, Paula, we were talking about how an incident in Ida B. Wells' life got personal in about 1892 when one of her friends was lynched. And can you pick it up from there a bit?
Yes. Ida Wells in 1892 was a journalist and a co-owner of a newspaper called the Memphis Free Speech. And a very good friend of hers was by the name of Thomas Moss, was a postman whose her office was on his route. And he was also, more importantly for this narrative, he was also the co-owner of a grocery store in Memphis, Tennessee, a co-owner with other African Americans it was a co-op grocery store, which was very emblematic of the growth of black business in this period of time in places like Memphis, Tennessee. And his store was a competitor to a white-owned store. And to make a long story short, the white owner really did a lot of provocative things to get provocative actions to get Thomas Moss and two other men who worked in the store arrested. And finally, while they were in jail, 75 masked men come into the jailhouse, grab those three men, and horribly torture and lynch them. And this was an important lesson to Wells. First of all, of course, the tragedy that her friend was lynched, and she was actually the godmother for his young daughter and good friends with Moss and his wife. But the lessons were interesting to her. You know, there was a rise in lynchings, and the rationale was that these lynchings were taking place because black men were raping white women. Mm-hmm. And she realizes that this is that people are really criminalizing black men, and that much of this is not true, as wasn't true with Thomas Moss. She understood that what was happening was really a repressive to repress African Americans to keep them from progressing as they were. And she actually is one of the first investigative reporters, Sharon, who especially after the Moss lynching, she goes around and investigates other lynchings. This is a period of time when there are 2 and 3 lynchings every week. Where several hundred lynchings are being done, you know, every year. And 1892 represents an apogee of annual lynchings, 241 lynchings that year. And she finds out, for one thing, is that many of these incidents that were called rape, were actually mutually relationships between mutually consenting adults, mm-hmm, between black women and white black men and white women, white women, of course, were their social construction, were these sort of innocent, passionless Southern belles, right? Mm-hmm, so she destroys that myth. Mm-hmm. She destroys the myth that black men are these horrible primitive monsters who are raping women, when she proves this by using statistics and actually proves the motives for rapes through her campaign. And of course, she's also protecting black women, because it was always thought that the reason why black men were so lascivious and vicious was because black women had no morality, and men weren't checking the sort of bestial instincts of men. So as she begins to write all of this and to really break down the stereotypes for every group, it's very important in terms of how people begin to understand the identities of different groups. And she breaks through. This is a period of time when much of these ideas around black people were supposedly scientific. And so she really begins to break all of that down, and that's very important. That was very important, and an important impact on, I think, particularly not just on the history itself, but intellectual history as well.
So this is one of the big impacts that Ida B. Wells drove. And I want to say once again that your book, I misquoted it. It's A Sword Among Lions.
Yes, Ida B. Wells. Sword Among Lions, right.
Yes, Ida B. Wells and the Campaign Against Lynching. That's an award winner with the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Well, you know, you also go into another area, and you know that I've read quite a bit of another one of your books that it seems like you're kind of alluding to in a way, and that's the When and Where I Enter, and the impact of black women on race and sex in America. And you know, there's so much that we could talk about with this one, Paula. And the research that you've done on it is just incredible. And is there anything that stands out that you would like to mention? You know, that has to do with the emergence of the strong black woman, or the drives and the influences that have come about from that book?
Well, one thing that's really, I think, important is, and first of all, let me. This is one thing I wanted to talk about a little bit too. The idea of the strong black woman can also be something that diminishes black women, because it's also a stereotype that if you're supposed to be strong, you're this kind of superwoman, as Michelle Wallace once wrote. She wrote a book called Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman, and that this superwoman can sort of do anything. She's impervious to all problems, and what this also sets up sometimes is that if a woman fails, that there's something wrong with her, because she's supposed to be this superwoman. If she succumbs to a lot of material realities, or et cetera. So we do have to be careful, I think, about that myth. There's pride in it, but we also have to be careful there's a stereotype that doesn't undermine us as well. But what I wrote in When and Where I Enter, Sharon, was You know, I asked the question before I wrote it. What is the role of us, and how do we think about our experience in this country? You know, it's obviously different than that of men, mm-hmm. including black men. It's obviously different than that of white women. So how do we think about, and at the time I was writing, and it seemed that we were just sort of adjuncts to both without a real history of our own. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. what I looked at was how black women had just a tremendous impact on both race movements, mm-hmm. even though we're marginalized sometimes from them in terms of the telling of the story, and also on women's movements. So mm-hmm. we've had an impact on it, and because we have an identity that's, you know, both gender and race, we often have an impact on the various different aspects of both movements at the same time. Let me give you a very quick example. You know, we think about Rosa Parks, and we think about how important she was as a catalyst for the civil rights movement, and there's this picture of her, of this little old lady who refuses, who's tired and doesn't want to get up from a bus seat, and, you know,
right.
it's so spontaneous. And well, you know, Rosa Parks began her career in the NAACP as an anti-rape activist.
Is that right?
In the 1940s, and this is a fascinating story, in the 1940s, she's asked to investigate a rape of a black woman, a gang rape of a black woman by white men. Mm-hmm. And in that investigation, which she brings to court eventually, but she mobilizes citizens, both men and women, in terms of this case, to publicize this case and to bring these, and the attempt to bring these men to justice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That group of citizens that she mobilized and that she brought together becomes the core of the Montgomery Improvement Association, which is responsible for the bus boycott.
Oh my gosh!
Well, that's the catalyst, and so you see how our experience and our identity of this kind of intersecting identity of around race, gender, and also sexuality, because we understand we're right at the center of all three of how this creates are working on all of these levels, and this is what we don't think about often, the civil rights movement, of how much gender and sexuality is a part of it as well.
Well, why don't we know this, Paula? Why do we not know that the beginnings of someone as now iconic as a Rosa Parks started out with her response, or was driven by really anti-rape measures, and which
because
ended up
we haven't really thought about what the academics would say is that we really haven't thought about sexuality and gender, but particularly sexuality now, as a category of analysis, as something to think about as part and parcel of a civil rights movement. We think about race, we don't think about gender, and we don't think about sexuality very much. And so, you know, and so that's how the story gets told. The story gets told in terms of race, not in terms of sexuality, not in terms of the fact that it was the rape. There was a number of instances of the rape of black women in the South that bring people together as activists, that bloomed civil rights movement. And
well,
but once you begin to look for those other aspects of our experience, then we begin to have a bigger and a better and a more comprehensive picture of our movements, of our social movements. And it is black women that really illuminates that full comprehensive picture, both of the women's movement that's too much thought of as a white woman's movement, but this is what Rosa Parks is doing as a woman's movement too, right? So and others as well. So black women really once we look at both of their of what they represent in terms of race and gender, and their mobilization around sexual vulnerability and violence, then this is when we get the whole picture.
Oh, my goodness, my goodness. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and I'd just like to read a comment on the way out from Aziz, who's a faithful listener from Kansas City, Missouri, and I quote, "Black women are the seat of civilization. If we would do what they tell us, we'd be better off." We'll be right back.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Ever wondered what private investigators really do and how they go about solving cases? Each week, PI's Declassified gives a glimpse into this little-known world. Join your host, Francie Kaler, a noted private investigator, in conversations with detectives and experts in the field. False confessions, forensic evidence, finding missing persons, exposing fraud, exonerating the innocent. All areas that Francie and her guests will cover. And have they got stories to tell? Tune in and call in to the live show Thursdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Oh, welcome back. Our guest today is Paula Giddings, who is author, journalist, and professor at Smith College. And we've got so much more to talk about, Paula, and so little time. So
yes.
Let's see what we can do to kind of get a few more areas and items in, because it's just extraordinary. We could spend a lot of time on what you've already brought forth. But maybe we could start with something for this segment that has to do with something that Marie from Missouri brought up. And mm-hmm. she sent in an email about today's show, and she says, yeah, in her opinion, yes, there is such a thing as a strong black woman, and it's because the white majority in the nation have never allowed opportunities on a large scale to black men. And number two, our black men are disproportionately imprisoned. And from the days of slavery, black women have had to be strong, and that continues today. She can only hope that black baby girls that are being born today will have the opportunity to be partners with the black men of their generation, of course, while remaining strong. What do you think of that?
Well, there's no question that that slavery and the fact that as a result of it, and as a result of the sort of ideology around race that comes out of the slave experience, that women haven't had, black women haven't had the same kinds of, you know, protections,
right.
Which is, in a way, it's understatement, of course.
Right.
But they haven't been shielded in ways, and they were expected to go beyond what the traditional gender roles are. For example, mm-hmm. very early on, black only black women were were allowed to work the ground, as they talked about it, and were taxed for doing so because they thought that their bodies were capable of doing hard physical labor that white women weren't. And of course Sojourner Truth speaks to this and others. So that has been true. It's a little dangerous to sort of say that, let me put it this way, you have to be more careful about talking about black women's strength only in comparison to black men's weakness
or problems.
Because it also undermines, I think, the heroic struggle also that black men have made as well. Now, mm-hmm. there's no question that there are this prison, which I alluded to earlier, this prison industrial complex has just been decimating aspects of the black community. Mm-hmm. But remember as well that women now are, I think, by percentage-wise, are even being put in jail at greater rates than men at this point. Mm. So we have to really begin to really think about policies and mobilize on this issue. And people like Angela Davis, of course, are out front and talking about the prison industrial complex and what it's doing to our communities. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, it's very easy to do that. But what we also have because of our experience, is what some of us call the kind of cult of respectability. The same thing was happening with Ida Wells, by the way, with people who were being lynched, mm-hmm. that people were not as enthusiastic about mobilizing for people who they felt must have done something wrong if they're in prison.
Uh-huh,
and of course,
uh-huh.
people do. And of course, you know, you can't say that every prisoner is a political prisoner.
Right.
But we have to understand larger. We have to understand policies like drug policies that are putting people in jail, the stop and frisk horror that's putting people in jail, the way people are being entrapped as well, and of course the poor education in inner cities and lack of employment. We have to look at those structural issues as well, mm-hmm. and so we do really have to think about, but not just in terms of just men. This is happening to women now as well, and so we have to think about. You know, it's a hard thing to do when someone says, "Does it ever over?" You know, we always have to just keep analyzing, and it is exhausting. But mm-hmm. we do have to think about both the particularity of what's happening to women and to men in our community, but also what's happening to both of them at the same time. So we can't just focus on, one gender when we're talking about these kinds of issues, but both and what's happening to the community as a whole. But at the same time, understanding that there are particular issues that are disproportionately affecting women and those disproportionately affecting men.
Well, I'll tell you, Paula, caller Marie from Detroit had this to offer. She says, "I've seen this trend. The white women were trophies for black athletes and entertainers, but now it's white women with black women physical attributes like," and she names Kim Kardashian. "The black woman is influencing beauty without saying it. We're becoming a new standard of beauty. She's white but has something black about her that is prized. It used to be just the suntan. Now it's deeper than that." What's your response to that?
Well, one of the things I talk about in my class as well, which is a black women's history class, are all of the physical aspects. You know, race is not just skin color, even though that's a large part of it. in terms of how we perceive race, because we know race has no real biological foundation at all, but in terms of how socially we think about race and the baggage that comes with race, certainly skin color is an aspect of it, but there are all kinds of other kinds of markers. Hair is another aspect, the fullness of lips and nose, et cetera, et cetera. What has always been what has often been attractive in this society are kind of exoticized features of people who have enough African American features or women of color features to sort of be the other, to represent the kind of wild sexuality that there are stereotypes around women of color. So just enough of a marker of a buttocks or lips or eyes or hair that's exciting and appealing sexually to some segments of the society, and yet not be too black or too negroid or too African. It's just another, you know, aspect of race and gender that we have to start breaking down and talking about and understanding.
Well, I tell you, Paula, our time is now gone, and we could spend a lot more on this particular topic with your background and experience. I want to thank you so much for joining us
Sharon,
today.
Well, thank you, Sharon. I really enjoyed this.
And once again, Paula's book, Paula Gittings' book, is A Sword Among Lions, Ida B. Wells, and the Campaign Against Lynching, winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize Award in Biography. We'll see you next time.
Thank you again for listening today. Please join host Sharon E. Davis for another edition of A Safe Place to Talk About Race next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll talk then.